Our case today is 2014-1797, Addiction and Detoxification v. Carpenter. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. We have an admission today. Motion by Judge Chen.
Thank you, Judge Moore. Today I move the admission of one of my law clerks, David O'Connor, who is a member of the bar and is in good standing with the highest court of California. I have knowledge of his credentials and am satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications. Mr. O'Connor has been one of my clerks for the past 16 months, and it has been a tremendous experience for me. He has definitely helped me think more deeply about the various cases we've confronted over the past year and 4 months, and I believe he will be an exceptional member of our bar. He's smart, talented, skilled, and has plenty of character. And I thank him for his service.
Do you think we should mull this one over?
No.
I've had the pleasure of getting to know David in his time here working for Judge Chen. I think I even got to chat with him quite a bit on the very first case he ever worked on for you, if I remember right, on almost his first day. And I can say that I very much enjoyed the experience and echo your praises. And I know that you'll be a valuable contribution to our bar. So I'd ask our clerk of court to please swear you in.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will comport yourself as an attorney and counsel of this court uprightly and according to law, and you will support the Constitution of the United States of America? I do. Congratulations, both of those who are involved.
Okay, now, case number 2014-1797, Addiction and Detoxification versus Carpenter. And is it Mirabal?
I'm Tom Mirabal.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Got it. Thank you for the accommodation to allow me to sit. While I make my presentation, I appreciate that a great deal. I hope it won't cause any inconvenience to the court whatsoever. Thank you.
We'll be fine. We're in the happy circumstance that we're very close, and therefore we can hear you quite well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Your Honor, this is a simple appeal. There's two main issues that are before the court. One was the district court's ruling that the complaint was insufficient in regard to the allegation of a breach of the 411 patent by the defendant as being a criteria in terms of a sufficiency of pleading. The court had mentioned in the opinion from the Eastern District that it was formalistic and followed a template. It's our avowed position that the quote-unquote notice requirement in regard to federal practice, we're not a fact pleading system in the federal court, reflects that the petition or the complaint that was filed is more than sufficient to give
notice to the defendant. Do you think the original complaint is more than sufficient to satisfy Form 18?
It's our understanding that our initial complaint, which we've used before, I represent the appellant is the initial developer of the patent and also the patent owner. So it's not an assignment of a patent or anything of that nature, as was alleged in the response brief from the appellant.
Right. I understand the other side characterizing the complaint as alleging no facts in terms of what activities are actually infringing your patent directly, other than simply repeating the legal standard for infringement that, you know, you own a patent and the other side is taking actions that infringe said patent. And if that's the case, then is there a problem with meeting the Form 18 requirement in that instance?
With all due respect, it's our position that the recitation of the defendant's violation of the 411 patent that's owned by the appellant, that the ownership is still in his possession. The patent is still valid. It involves a rapid detoxification process for heroin addicts. My client is a medical doctor. We believe that the requirements of the federal system, at least based on the field code, is that essentially that we give a sufficient notice to the defendant that, in fact, a lawsuit is being brought against him and being brought against him for a specific cause of action. And we believe we sufficiently provided that information in our complaint. If we did not, mind you, we had made a motion to amend the complaint, which was denied by the court. The court appeared to rest a significant amount of the argument on the fact that we had not given pre-notice to the defendant that a suit was being brought for violation of a 411 patent. It's our avowed position that the pre-notice requirement is not there. It is not required by any federal statute or any case. We have numerous cases we have cited.
Mr. Mirabli?
Yes.
Let's assume for the moment that we agree with you that Form 18, as a matter of law, does not require the patent owner to provide the defendant some type of pre-complaint filing notice of infringement before the actual filing of the complaint. At the same time, it's my understanding that this court has de novo review here and could potentially affirm the dismissal of your complaint on an alternative ground. For example, the other side is claiming that there's still an insufficiency of meeting Form 18's requirements, and one of them is the fact that maybe there wasn't enough pled in terms of identifying what actual actions the defendant does to infringe your patent. I'm thinking about paragraph 12 of the complaint, which says that the defendant is engaging in procedures, I think is the word, that infringe the method patent. And I guess what I'm wondering is, do you think that if your patent was for an apparatus, for example, and your complaint said the defendant's products are infringing my apparatus patent claims, do you think that would be sufficient for Form 18?
It may not be if we're talking about an apparatus, but we're talking about a process here. The 411 patent pertains to a procedure for rapid detoxification for heroin addiction, and it's very specific. So when we say procedure, we're referring directly to the nature of the procedure that's encompassed within the 411 patent. It's my understanding that perhaps if we're talking about a product notification in regard to a mark, a violation of a mark, or something more specific may in fact be appropriate. But in terms of the standard to notify, and I assume we're working under the assumption that what we are doing in terms of the complaint under the notice system is we're informing the defendant that he's being sued or she's being sued, that there is a cause of action against them with enough specificity that they realize what it relates to, which in this case would be the 411 patent, and that we seek redress from the court in regard to the petition. Now, I think the district court in Michigan had the option, if they were concerned with the phraseology of the complaint, to allow for the amendment of the complaint to comport to whatever criteria that judge would, in his discretion, seek appropriate. But to dismiss the case on the basis of the quote unquote lack of notice under Form 18, together with the denial of the motion to amend the complaint, really places my client in a conundrum. If we were to rely on this ruling, what that means is that my client is effectively dead in the water. They do not have the option to give notice, again, in some manner, give notice under the 401, then reinstitute a lawsuit, because I believe this appears to be a substantive dismissal of the case.
You presumably have done a pre-filing investigation in this case of the defendant's activities, right?
Excuse me?
You've done a pre-filing investigation of the defendant's activities.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've satisfied yourself that they do, in fact, use a diarrhea suppressant in their process?
Your Honor, in all the cases we're involved in, one of the key issues will be is whether or not there is an anesthetic suppressant being used and a diuretic suppressant. And quite candidly, that seems to be the substance of all the cases, because the typical defense is that, well, we don't use the whole thing, we just use some of the procedure.
That would sound like a pretty good defense if, in fact, it's true. If they have four limitations, they only perform three.
The problem that we have from our perspective is it's our understanding, and I'm not a doctor, that to do this procedure without using an antidiuretic and without either using an anesthetic places the patient at risk, literally of death. There's a hydration issue that becomes involved.
Well, I understand. Okay, let me. I was really trying to get at a different point. The question I have really is, have you satisfied yourself based on information that they do in fact use a diarrhea suppressant, or are you guessing that they do because it would seem exercising due caution should?
From the information we have, plus also, again, based on the premise that if you don't use a diuretic, the patient faces cardiac arrest. So I've had conversations.
I mean, when you say from the information and plus the
plus also
the
we
risk
have,
that
we
would
have
be associated with not doing it. I'm really trying to probe what the information is that you have that they use, affirmative information that they use.
We have information from a woman in Detroit that also was engaged in this type of activity.
Yeah.
That these defendants were also using the same procedure.
With a diarrhea suppressant.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And that's on the basis of which we investigated the defendants and located the defendants and initiated litigation.
But based on this woman providing you with information?
Yes, and also the information on the website, plus also the premise that...
Their website doesn't indicate that they use a diuretic suppressant.
Excuse me?
Their website does not indicate, does it, that they use a diuretic suppressant?
I understand that, but...
Does it? Am I mistaken? Is there anything on their website that indicates that?
We work on the premise that we have physicians that we consult with and nurse practitioners in regard to
my question was specific.
Pardon?
Does their website indicate they use a diuretic suppressant?
I don't believe it does.
Okay, but you cited their website as some of the evidence that contributed to your investigation.
I'm
trying to understand precisely the nature of that evidence. So this woman, what precisely did she say that gave you reason? Was she a patient who actually had them perform the procedure and she can tell you, yes, in fact, they gave me a diuretic suppressant? Was she a former employee of theirs who witnessed them doing this and administering a diuretic suppressant? What is the nature of the information you have?
Well, as I said, the information from the woman that was also engaged, her and her associate that were also engaged in this rapid detoxification process.
Working with these defendants?
Right. The information.
Right. Yes, she worked for these defendants.
We were advised that these defendants were engaged in that activity.
By whom?
By the individuals that were also engaged in that process at another organization up in Detroit.
So a totally separate organization that performs a process,
yes,
who happens to use, they happen to use a diuretic.
Yes.
What were they able to tell you factually about how these people are performing the process?
They informed us that, in fact, the particular defendants here learned the procedure from that particular, those particular women, had worked with them at some point, and had broken off and started their own owned enterprise using this particular procedure. So it's the information that, that essentially the process was taught to them by the individuals that we have information in Detroit, gave us the information, plus also, as I said, medical testimony or medical information.
So they've
to the
now,
that you cannot
they've
do
now
it without.
Asserted in legal documents, their lawyer has asserted in the briefs to this court that their client has never, does not, and will not use a diuretic suppressant in any way. Are you suggesting that it's possible we should bring them up on charges for unethical conduct for making a false statement?
Well, it's a matter of proof, is it not?
No, I don't actually think so. I think when a lawyer makes a statement of fact and signs a document representing what his client does, that that's not a matter of proof, is it? I mean, that's a isn't at that point he on the hook for ensuring the accuracy of what he is representing to the court?
I believe that would first be up to the discretion of the court. But these allegations were not made lightly. And
so if this case is remanded for any reason, if we find your complaint was in fact sufficient and we remand this case, and if they move for summary judgment of non-infringement and they put forth affidavits of their doctors that say, we have not administered any diuretic suppressants in our use of our process, doesn't that end this case?
Your Honor, I think what it also presents is that we have not even engaged in discovery. We're being knocked out of the box before we have the ability to be able to engage in discovery.
Discovery is not a fishing expedition, sir. You have to have proof that they infringe the elements of these claims. It's your obligation before bringing proof, before bringing suit, to have proof. If they are stating on the record that they have not performed this process, do not perform it, and all you have is a woman who says, well, I trained them, and when I trained them, I taught them to do this. That doesn't mean they're doing it. I train my kids to do all kinds of stuff every single day, and you know what? Probably I get a 50% realization rate. What is the proof that they're actually doing that, that they're using a diuretic suppressant?
Well, I think that's an issue of discovery and actual trial in this matter. If we would find out in discovery in some
if there is a trial in this matter form, under those circumstances, it will be a travesty of justice.
To be able to move from a complaint to engage in discovery.
When you have absolutely no evidence or proof that they're performing one of the elements of the patent claim, when you filed a complaint against them where you even forgot to put their name in multiple places because it's a form complaint that reads identically to all the other complaints you filed against everybody else. I don't know if you realize that. The complaint you filed in this case doesn't even use their name in several spots. It uses the name of the previous people you filed with the same complaint. Yes, I would say under those circumstances it feels a lot more like a fishing expedition to me than it feels like a lawsuit.
With all due respect, I don't believe that what we're engaged in is a fishing expedition where we initiated a complaint based upon the information that we had. We believe that that's sufficient information to be able to initiate a complaint within the federal system and to engage, of course, further engage in discovery and all the other things that are appropriate to be able to find the facts and join the issue finally to trial. We're not trying the case by a complaint being filed, mind you. I know that there's a tendency today to use a motion to dismiss for a way to circumvent the process of discovery and also the process of trial in these matters. But I think to some degree we're missing the point in regard to my client believing that his patent rights have been violated. The information that we have, we can't go into their office. We can't access their medical practice. We cannot do that until we have the penumbra of the court to be able to engage in discovery to determine, in fact, the degree and extent but merely trying to base it on what said, is said or not said on a website seems to me to be a very, very limited window for a complainant to be able to proceed with litigation.
Okay. We'll restore a few minutes of your rebuttal time. Why don't we hear from opposing counsel?
Good. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hulleberger. Am I saying that one right?
Yes, Hulleberger.
So do you think, Mr. Hulleberger, that patent law requires giving someone written notice before a complaint is filed?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mr. Hulleberger, may it please the Court. I believe under the patent laws, the statute, such notice is not required. But I believe that if you're going to come into a district court and file a complaint, and then you're going to rely on Form 18, then you have to, in fact, follow Form 18. You don't get to pick and choose what you're going to do on Form 18. You have to follow what is required. And the oral argument we just heard about the facts, Your Honor, I'd like to say that even if this panel were to determine that written notice is not required under the law on Form 18, and Judge Chen, I think you said as a matter of law, it doesn't require it. If that is your decision, for many reasons, this complaint still fails to plead any facts. And I would distinguish and I would point to In Re Bill of Lading and KTEC, where both cases relied on the defendant's websites. I believe it was KTEC, they relied on the defendant's patent. And there was a lot of information that was in, I believe In Re Bill of Lading had 100 pages of a complaint and exhibits.
Well, that may be, but the ultimate holding, as I read it, of both cases, was that regardless of what the Supreme Court may have said in Twombly and Iqbal with respect to the rules that apply outside of the forms, if you are within the context of the forms, and Form 18 is directed to patent infringement, then that's a safe harbor.
It's a safe harbor.
You've already argued that it's a safe harbor if you follow the provisions, including a provision which at least seems not wholly applicable here on pre-filing notice, but you do acknowledge that the general rule of Iqbal and Twombly don't seem to apply in the Form 18 context, do you not?
Well, obviously in KTEC and Iqbal, this court said the forms control. I think the Supreme Court pretty much has determined that issue for you in 6 more months, assuming Congress enacts the amended civil procedure rules where they eliminate the forms in Rule 84. Right. I think this discussion doesn't happen anymore.
Well, it may not, but
it still is now.
Right, unless we hold this case, well, even if we hold this case for 6 months, the rules that apply will be the rules that were applicable at the time of filing, I assume.
Certainly. Well, let me address your question about whether or not this notice provision in paragraph 4 of Form 18. The issue here is, in particular, this is a method. And I would propose, and do argue in our brief, that if you're going to strictly construe this Form 18, you have to strictly construe it. We've already, as this court has said, excluded indirect infringement from Form 18. We've already excluded willfulness from Form 18. Then I would say we have to look at Form 18 as to what it is. It is a complaint for a direct infringement of an apparatus claim. And it makes sense, I think, if you look at paragraph 4, which talks about complying with the statutory requirement of placing notice on letters of patents, or of the letters of patents, on all electric motors it manufactures. And in response, the appellant said, this is a method. We don't have to give notice.
How? Assume, let's walk away from Form 18 for a moment. And let's assume that this is a Twombly, Iqbal type situation. How much information do you think would be, at minimum, required to be in the complaint in order for the complaint to survive a motion to dismiss? We have, I guess you have four limitations in your, let's just look at claim one. Four limitations, I think it is. Suppose they say that you infringe by engaging in a method of detoxifying a patient by sedating the patient with an anesthetic, administering a diarrhea suppressant, injecting an opioid antagonist, and then reviving the patient from the effects of the anesthetic agents. Those are their allegations. Would that be sufficient in your view?
I don't believe it would, no.
What more would be needed?
Well, Judge Bryson, I think it's almost similar to what they say currently, that we practice a claim method. If they just recited back the elements of the claim, that doesn't do anything. That doesn't allege any facts. That's alleging what the claim says.
Well, it's alleging, in a sense, it's alleging facts, because the question of whether one sedates a patient with an anesthetic agent is a fact. I mean, are you saying that they have to name the anesthetic agent?
No, not at all.
What do they have to do then, beyond simply reciting those limitations?
Sure, they have to provide the facts. And if those are the facts and they have the evidence of that...
What facts?
I'll give you the example, and I'll talk about KTAC. KTAC, they cited the dependent patents. We have published patent applications, which describe our method in detail. They go through all of our steps. I would suspect someone who did a Rule 11 analysis would look at those and would provide in their complaint, here's what we're talking about. We think you're infringing by this. But they can't, because we don't provide diarrhea suppressants.
Well, but they say that you do. Okay, so if they allege in their complaint that you do, and your answer to them is, no, we don't, isn't that a factual dispute at that point? What's missing from the existence of a factual dispute? That looks very factual to me.
At least then they will have alleged what they believe we're doing.
Right, but you told me that was insufficient.
Well, and I only refer that in the sense of insufficient if they are referring to the claims step. If they're putting it in the fact that they say we are doing this, and if they were to cite our website, the published patent application. But I think the crux of it is they can't. Because if they do, much like Judge Moore said about filing statements by attorneys saying they do this or they have a reasonable on information and belief doing something, there is none of that. Because my doctors don't do it. And in fact, they have maintained ever since they got the complaint from the first day when I called them and they said, we don't do diarrhea suppressants. In fact, they take the opposite position.
It would seem to me, depending, I guess, on how willing the district judge is to be a little bit creative here with summary judgment process, it would seem to me that you could have probably filed a motion for summary judgment very promptly, and the district court would have presumably asked Mr. Mirabli, what kind of discovery do you need in order to respond to the summary judgment motion, and don't ask for the world, because I want to give you targeted discovery to the specific question of do you use a diarrhea suppressant, and you would have been done in a week. Instead, you've got us involved, you've got this case going on for months, and it seems to me that this whole process of using motions to dismiss to do what we've always previously done by summary judgment is really in many ways more inefficient. I recognize the costs of discovery can be brutal, but it seems to me with a little imagination the discovery can be so focused that you can get a factual and final disposition of this case very promptly with a targeted summary judgment motion. Why not go that way?
If you knew what you had to defend against, perhaps that's an option.
Well, you know exactly what you have to defend against because you know what your defense is. Your defense is, we don't use a diarrhea suppressant, period, end of case. And if you can establish that in one-page affidavit from your chief doctor and they don't have anything coming back at you, you win. Why not? What am I missing?
I don't think that's how the district courts conduct their business, unfortunately.
Well, many do. Many do.
I would like to believe that, and unfortunately, I think the answer is because they don't plead they don't push from possibility to probability or from possibility to plausibility any facts. And unless they do that, I, as the defendant, don't have to do those things because they haven't satisfied their burden.
With regard, there were multiple counts or multiple claims, it appears to be, in both the original complaint and the amended complaint. Both of them suggested induced and contributory infringement as well. And as you recognize, that's not Form 18 applicable. The lower court, it seems, in addition, on those claims, indicated there was no factual allegation of specific intent. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And does the amended complaint cure that defect?
No, they do not. All they do, once again, in the amended complaint is use the pleading requirements, or not the pleading requirements, but the buzzwords to satisfy the element of the particular claims. They don't have any facts, and that comes to mind as aiding and abetting. They put aiding and abetting in there as one of the proof of intent or their allegations of intent, but there's no
You don't think it's
fact.
Enough for them to say you encourage, your doctors exercise dominion and control over defendant Eagle Advancement, and you encourage, aid, or instruct others to perform one or more of the steps?
Correct.
And it says you encourage them to perform one or more of the steps with specific intent to urge and instruct, encourage such infringement.
And let's talk about in the I think it was K-Tech again, where there was arguments about the cable companies communicating or having some sort of discussions for that sort of satisfying the intent. And there has to be more. You have to say in that particular case, I think they talked about the contracts or the discussions that they had, and at least that put them on notice. And that's what's lacking here. There is, outside of repeating aiding and abetting, there is nothing.
Yeah, that they don't articulate a specific act that you are doing or encouraging someone else to do or anything like that. Is that the idea?
That's correct. And again, from the mindset of the defendants here.
And what about specific intent? What do you think? Do you think it's enough to say, well, you had knowledge of the patent? Would that satisfy, in your mind, the Twombly standard for the specific intent that's necessary?
Well, I think, I don't remember the name of just the case that just came down where it talked about Kamel. Where they said, you have to have the specific intent to cause the infringement. So I think it is something more than just knowledge of the patent that you need to plead and to prove for the indirect infringement.
Do you think they need to identify the name of the procedure, whether it be for direct or indirect infringement? Like, do you have a menu of services? I mean, is it what I'm sort of along the lines of what Judge Bryson was asking before. I'm trying to understand how specific. I mean, Form 18, for example, just says you sell electric motors that infringe the patent. Electric motors embodying the patent, something like that.
Can I tell you why?
So what if they say here you sell procedure? You offer procedures identical to those claimed.
I'll tell you why I think the Form 18 is okay when it says electric motors. And I can tell you why I think in this particular case with method it's not, with the procedures that we perform. When you have the electric motor and when you make a product, you can go out and buy it and I can buy it and you know what you made because you sold it and I have a copy of it. And when I say this infringes, you have it and I have it and we can all look at it and then we can have a debate about the merits of the facts of whether that infringes. When you talk about a process, and in particular treating patients, it's not tangible. This is something that outside of in the fact that we do have a published patent application, which they could have looked at, outside of that, if they're just going to say you perform steps, there's no way I can easily show that I don't do something. Because once they've alleged that I do it, and Judge Bryson, to your point, trying to prove that we don't do something, at least in the world that I practice in district courts, it doesn't take much for them to, a district court judge, to continue the litigation.
I would think, under Celotex, you file an affidavit which says we don't do it, and they come back and say we don't believe them. That won't do it. You win. Judgment for the defendant. I mean, isn't that your understanding of the way Celotex works? It's mine.
In that particular court, it did, yes.
Is your problem mainly that you think that the floodgates will open and then you'll be mired in discovery on all kinds of issues and that somehow it won't get narrowly focused? I mean, if Judge Bryson were the district court judge, maybe he would keep it narrowly focused, but that might not happen and you just don't want to end up with...
Well, Judge Moore, I can tell you...
...expense in years of...
You obviously know the other matters or the other litigations that have been filed by this particular plaintiff. The majority of those all end in bankruptcy of the...
Individuals
and or the clinics. And there was one in the, I believe we cited it in the joint appendix, a decision from the Illinois court where they ruled that the complaint failed 12B6 and they dismissed it. And then they refiled and then 12 months later, there was a notice of closing the case with a bankruptcy. A similar, exact same complaint in Eastern District of Michigan followed our complaint where the judge dismissed it and that wasn't appealed. And so, I mean, the performance or the acts of the plaintiff patent holder in these particular cases, I think, is what concerns the defendants and why if they aren't going to do what they have to do, I don't want to have to go and argue high octane for attorney's fees after we win the case. We don't want to be in this case. They don't want to have to do it because they're not practicing the method and there's no evidence that they are.
How many of these cases have there been? You've mentioned two or three.
I want to say maybe six.
And how many of them ended in bankruptcy? You mentioned one.
I'm aware of, I think, three have. There's this one, the other Eastern District of Michigan.
Was there ever a factual resolution where they, did they all turn on whether there was the use of a diarrhea suppressant?
I don't know they progressed far enough, quite honestly.
Okay.
In your honors, what I'd like to say is that the Supreme Court, in abrogating Form 18 and its statement in Camo, that it's the authority and the responsibility of the district courts to ensure cases are dissuaded, we ask you to affirm the decision.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hollenberger. Mr. Mirable, we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may make a comment, the insinuation is to some degree that, we're trollish in what we're doing, that we brought other suits, and we have. We brought five.
Five
suits, yes. And,
is it
and of the five, one is outstanding, the others have been settled through extensive litigation, mind you. The comment about the case where the defendant ended up in bankruptcy, in that particular case, Judge Chow in Chicago had a citation for contempt against the defendant because we had for a significant period of time attempted to get his deposition to be able to testify as to the procedure. Now, in his case, he actually worked for the appellant at one time and was involved in performing this particular procedure. The bankruptcy was not as a result of, quote-unquote, some vicious activity of the, quote-unquote, trolls. We're not trolls. I represent the patent developer. I represent the doctor that developed this detoxification process, and he holds a 411 patent on that. It's not troll-like to try to enforce what rights you happen to have under patent. But my concern dominantly in regard to this is we're trying fact cases now by pleading. Essentially, the motion to dismiss has become the new demur. Quote unquote, there's not enough facts alleged to be able to state a cause of action. Well, we're not a fact pleading system. In the federal system, at least it's my understanding, what we are is a notice pleading system. And, quote unquote, if we file a petition and it does not state sufficient facts for the court, we should be allowed to amend. But even if we did amend and we stand on the petition we have now, we have the right, yes, they could file summary judgment, but we also have the right to take a deposition under oath and look at the defendant to say, what procedures are you specifically using? Because the argument always is, well, we're not using this procedure. We're using some of it, but not all of it. Or what we're using is a anesthetic, and the anesthetic is tramadol. Well, or we're not using an anesthetic, we're just using tramadol. Well, tramadol is a opiate-based pharmaceutical. By definition, it's a anesthetic. So we get into even the dialogue of breaking down and parsing words in terms of, well, it's an anesthetic, it's not an anesthetic, we don't do this, we don't do that. But the end process is certain things must be done for a rapid detoxification for heroin to occur. And one of the things that's paramount to the process is an antidiuretic. Because the process would, literally what would happen is the electrolytes and the hydration of the patient would reduce to, or would come, so become so acute that the person would suffer cardiac arrest. That's why the antidiarrheal is critical to the quote-unquote magic of this particular patent. But I thank you for your time, and I thank you for your interest in the case. Thank you very much.
Thank both counsel. The case is taken under submission.
All rise.